Good morning, everyone. I hope you're having it's Sunday, so we're here doing this. It's hard to tell what day of the week it is in the middle of all this, but here we are, and it's Palm Sunday. This is a day for stopping and reflecting on both the triumphal entry and the week that follows, and what goes into that. And so I thought we'd start with the wonderful cross and just remember and reflect on what happened this week, almost 2,000 years ago. Well, good morning, everybody. Glad to see a few of you are actually here now. That's fantastic. Our first reading today is from Matthew chapter 21, verses 1 through 11. Matthew 21, verses 1 through 11. As Jesus and the disciples approached Jerusalem, they came to the town of Bethphage on the Mount of Olives. Jesus sent two of them on ahead. "Go into the village over there," he said. "As soon as you enter it, you will see a donkey tied there, with its colt beside it. Untie them and bring them to me. If anyone asks what you are doing, just say, 'The Lord needs them,' and he will immediately let you take them. This took place to fulfill the prophecy that said, tell the people of Jerusalem, look, your king is coming to you. He is humble, riding on a donkey, riding on a colt. The two disciples did as Jesus commanded. They brought the donkey and the colt to him and threw their garments over the colt, and he sat on it. Most of the crowd spread their garments on the road ahead of him, and others cut branches from the trees and spread them on the road. Jesus was in the center of the procession, and the people all around him were shouting, praise God for the Son of David! Blessings on the one who comes in the name of the Lord! Praise God in the highest heaven! The entire city of Jerusalem was in an uproar as he entered. Who is this? They asked. And the crowds replied, it is Jesus, the prophet from Nazareth in Galilee. That's where the week started, and that's our first reading. The second reading is where the week ended, and it's from a couple chapters later, Matthew chapter 27, verses 11 through 54. Let us listen for the word of the Lord. Matthew 27, 11 through 54. Now Jesus was standing before Pilate, the Roman governor. Are you the king of the Jews? The governor asked him. Jesus replied, you have said it. But when the leading priests and the elders made their accusations against him, Jesus remained silent. Don't you hear all these charges they are bringing against you? Pilate demanded. But Jesus made no response to any of the charges, much to the governor's surprise. Now it was the governor's custom each year during the Passover celebration to release one prisoner to the crowd, anyone they wanted. This year, there was a notorious prisoner, a man named Barabbas. As the crowds gathered before Pilate's house that morning, he asked them, which one do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Messiah? He knew very well that the religious leaders had arrested Jesus out of envy. Just then, as Pilate was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent him this message, leave that innocent man alone. I suffered through a terrible nightmare about him last night. Meanwhile, the leading priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas to be released and for Jesus to be put to death. So the governor asked again, which of these two do you want me to release to you? The crowd shouted back, Barabbas! Pilate responded, then what should I do with Jesus, who is called the Messiah? They shouted back, crucify him! Why? Pilate demanded, what crime has he committed? But the mob roared even louder, crucify him! Pilate saw that he wasn't getting anywhere and that a riot was developing, so he sent for a bowl of water and washed his hands before the crowd, saying, I am innocent of this man's blood. The responsibility is yours. And all the people yelled back, we will take responsibility for his death, we and our children. So Pilate released Barabbas to them. He ordered Jesus flogged with a lead-tipped whip and turned him over to the Roman soldiers to be crucified. Some of the governor's soldiers took Jesus into their headquarters and called out the entire regiment. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. They wove thorn branches into a crown and put it on his head, and they placed a reed stick in his right hand as a scepter. Then they knelt before him in mockery and taunted, Hail, King of the Jews! And they spit on him and grabbed the stick and struck him on the head with it. When they were finally tired of mocking him, they took off the robe and put his own clothes on him again. Then they led him away to be crucified. Along the way, they came across a man named Simon, who was from Cyrene, and the soldiers forced him to carry Jesus' cross. And they went out to a place called Golgotha, which means place of the skull. The soldiers gave Jesus wine mixed with bitter gall, but when he had tasted it, he refused to drink it. After they had nailed him to the cross, the soldiers gambled for his clothes by throwing dice. Then they sat around and kept guard as he hung there. A sign was fastened above Jesus' head announcing the charge against him. It read, This is Jesus, the King of the Jews. Two revolutionaries were crucified with him, one on his right and one on his left. The people passing by shouted abuse, shaking their heads in mockery. Look at you now, they yelled at him. You said you were going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. Well then, if you are the Son of God, save yourself and come down from the cross. The leading priests, the teachers of the religious law, the elders also mocked Jesus. He saved others, they scoffed, but he can't save himself. So he is the King of Israel, is he? Let him come down from the cross right now, and we will believe in him. He trusted God, so let God rescue him now if he wants to save him. For he said, I am the Son of God. Even the revolutionaries who were crucified with him ridiculed him in the same way. At noon, darkness fell across the whole land until 3 o'clock. At about 3 o'clock, Jesus called out in a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you abandoned me? Some of the bystanders misunderstood and thought he was calling for the prophet Elijah. One of them ran and filled a sponge with sour wine, holding it up to him on a reed stick so he could drink. But the rest said, wait, let's see whether Elijah comes to save him. Then Jesus shouted out again, and he released his spirit. At that moment, the curtain in the sanctuary of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook, the rocks split apart, and tombs opened. The bodies of many godly men and women who had died were raised from the dead. They left the cemetery after Jesus' resurrection, went into the holy city of Jerusalem, and appeared to many people. The Roman officer and the other soldiers at the crucifixion were terrified by the earthquake and all that had happened. They said, this man was truly the Son of God. That's the word of the Lord. Often in Holy Week, we split these two stories far apart. And on Palm Sunday, we wave palm branches and celebrate and, in a way, partake of that giddiness and hopeful, triumphant entry where everyone in Jerusalem, the crowds are screaming, Hail, King of the Jews. It ends with the same line, Hail, King of the Jews, but in a very different circumstance and with a very different meaning. This week, since we're not doing Maundy Thursday and we're not spreading it out, I think it's worth putting these two stories right next to each other, juxtaposing the incredible common threads and incredible differences of these two events, of Jesus' entry into Jerusalem and his exit from Jerusalem. I mean, he comes in and the crowds are deeply involved in both stories. I'm amazed how, well, they, the crowds, us, are all hoping for Jesus to be the Savior we expected. They want him to be Messiah, King of the Jews. They want him, in their case, to start the revolution that will finally kick the Romans out. It's what they are profoundly hoping for. They believe Jesus is this Messiah. Of course, by the end of the week, that goes incredibly south. They are beyond disappointed that Jesus is not the Messiah they were hoping for. I wonder, we see in these stories just how fickle the adoration of the crowds can be. But in that, I hope we don't separate that from ourselves and recognizing how fickle our own perspectives can be. How often we can turn on people we may have put our hopes in or friendship with when things don't go the way we were hoping. These stories show how few inches separate our triumphs and our tragedies. And just as the crowd can be fickle, we ourselves can be incredibly fickle. Reality can be incredibly fickle. One week everything can be fine, and a couple weeks later we're all isolated and sitting in our houses and not going to work and have no idea where all this is heading. We are fragile. We love to be in situations where we can pretend that all is well. Everything is secure. But I think that security is usually an illusion. Things can change incredibly rapidly. Surely now we can reflect and learn that there is so much we have taken for granted, so much that we've been unconscious of and ungrateful for. Being able to go to the store, being able to eat at a restaurant or gather together in church on a weekly basis, being able to get together and talk to a friend. So many of these things that we didn't think would change are now we are going without. Lent is this season, of course, of going without, of giving something up for a time and remembering there's something we want more. But it also teaches us so much about those things that we like and we love, and it teaches us to appreciate them on a deeper level. And now for a time, we are going without social interactions. We go without our gatherings, without touch, without shared meals, all of our wonderful common spaces. And on an even deeper level, I think we also go without certainty, not knowing how this will or when this will end, not knowing whether we will get the disease ourselves, or if we do, if we'll survive, or if we will lose loved ones. There's so much beyond our control and so much uncertainty. And I actually think this is a very powerful experience for us. It is reality that can teach us some amazing things about God, ourselves, our world, what we're doing in it. I think we all, at some point in the last few weeks, have felt somewhat alone, somewhat forsaken, somewhat discouraged. And that's where these stories lead us today. Jesus, God's self incarnate with us, adored by the crowds one minute and the next minute completely rejected. They ask this same crowd who is crying, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord," whether they want him or the murderer Barabbas. And Jesus is rejected. They choose Barabbas instead. Jesus is mocked. He's humiliated. He's completely isolated. The story, the way Matthew tells it here, shows Jesus completely alone. John doesn't do this, but Matthew makes no mention of any of Jesus' disciples or anybody being with him in the middle of this. And of course, this rises to this crescendo of Jesus on the cross crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why am I abandoned and alone?" The crowd is asking those questions. If, you know, if God really wants him, why won't God save him? Sure seems like this experience he's going through proves that he's not with God, that God, he isn't God's son, that God isn't with him. We want to skip over this and get to resurrection. But I think it's important for us to stop and spend some time with Jesus in this suffering. Because the truth is that in all of our lives, suffering will come. None of us have, let's put it like this. Walking through the valley of the shadow of death is not optional for we as human beings. It is a place where all of us at some point in our lives go. And incarnation, the idea that God would become one of us, with us, implies that God must also be with us in our suffering. God's love for us results in the suffering of God. Any God who is with us must also be suffering with us. There is, and it's somewhat lost in the West, but I would like to take steps towards reclaiming it, a rich religious tradition of lament, of expressing sadness and dismay and discouragement with the tragedy and the suffering in life. In fact, there's a whole book in the Old Testament called Lamentations. It's a poem, hymn, written to express the incredible sadness and discouragement of Jerusalem being destroyed, of all of the hopes of the people of Israel being crushed with the invasion of Babylon. That's, of course, just one of the tragedies in Earth's history, which history is often a recording of immense tragedies. And we're going through a time right now which is somewhat tragic. There's all sorts of people who are losing important and amazing things. People are dying. People are suffering. And anytime this happens, we ask the question, where is God? Why, if we are a little bit with the crowd, right? Like, if God actually loved us, then this wouldn't be happening. I think that's where this story is so important for us to sit with, to remember, to face the grief, the aloneness, the discouragement, and recognize that those are real parts of life too. I think it's important to be able to sit with the suffering without answers, without solutions. This is the book of Job, right? Many scholars, well, some scholars, think it's the earliest book in the Bible written. And Job is entirely about a good person, Job, having horrible tragedy and horrible suffering overwhelm his life. He loses his wealth. He loses his livelihood. He loses his children. He loses his health. And then most of the book is a discussion about why, how to understand this. Job has no idea, doesn't get it. He has friends who come and reason with him and say, there has to be a cause for this. And we think it's you. You've probably done something. You've sinned. This tragedy in your life must have been caused by something. And Job argues with that tenaciously, refuses to believe that there is a meaning to this suffering. And my favorite part of the book is that when God shows up at the end, God doesn't offer any explanations for why the suffering or the tragedy. And I think the book of Job leaves those unresolved. But God defends Job in his insistence that there was not a cause to this. Oh my goodness, I don't know if I should get started, but I probably should, because I've seen some Christians and people stating that what is happening in the world right now is God's judgment on us. And this is precisely the argument Job's friends were making, and it's absurd. Any God who does that is a vindictive, small, horrible God who really has it in for old people. That God cannot be an actual God. I can imagine a far better God than that. But the loss persists. And where is God in this? Job argues that there isn't a reason. And God validates Job at the end of the book and says, my servant Job has spoken well of me. He has refused to conceive of me as a God who would vindictively do this sort of thing. There is suffering and loss that comes to every life. And instead of running away from it or being afraid of it, I believe like Jesus, we can face it. We can drink the cup offered to us. I came across this poem this past week by T.S. Eliot called Wait Without Hope. And it may be one of my favorite things I've read in years. I'd like to read it for you this morning. Wait Without Hope by T.S. Eliot. I said to my soul, be still and wait without hope. For hope would be hope for the wrong thing. Wait without love. For love would be love of the wrong thing. There is yet faith, but the faith and the love and the hope are all in the waiting. Wait without thought, for you are not ready for thought. So the darkness shall be the light and the stillness the dancing. Whisper of running streams and winter lightning, the wild thyme unseen and wild strawberry, the laughter in the garden, echoed ecstasy, not lost, but requiring, pointing to the agony of death and birth. Wait without hope, for hope would be hope for the wrong thing. In these two stories, the stories of Palm Sunday, of the crowd hoping desperately that Jesus is this temporal Messiah they hope him to be, we see that their hope and their love is for the wrong thing. They are hoping for something so much less than God is actually offering. And allowing them to go through the loss of that hope is actually an incredibly profound gift from God. One that I think God continues to give us. When reality becomes a very hard and difficult teacher in crushing some of the false hopes that we might be harboring, some of the false loves of the wrong thing that we might be cherishing and cultivating. Wait without love, for love would be love of the wrong thing. When we say we love God, what is it that we love? Is it a God who keeps us safe and prevents us from dying and makes us prosperous and all of these temporal things? Because I fear that for most, myself included, that might be the thing that we say that we love when we love God. That, like the early disciples of Jesus, might be we too might be in for an incredibly heartrending loss, suffering. Like the disciples, our hope is often in the wrong things. Our loves are out of order and bent. But reality can be our teacher. We can have the wisdom and the patience to sit without hope, knowing that if we jump to a new hope too soon, our hopes might still be for the wrong things. Our old systems and habits and routines dying, we can emerge and learn and grow. Death is universal, but in Jesus we see that even death is not evidence that God has forsaken us. And while death does not get the last word, there are times where we too encounter death and are subject to it for a time. I love this ending. The whisper of the streams still speak, the sun still quietly shines, and the rain gently falls. The wild thyme unseen and the wild strawberry, not lost, but requiring pointing to the agony of death and birth. We too can lament. We can sit with the sadness, the loss, with death. One of my favorite, I think I'll go to Psalm 22. This is what Jesus is quoting when he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why have you abandoned me? Why do I feel so alone? I think this is just a powerful, it is a prayer, an unwillingness to abandon. I mean, Jesus turns to God in the midst of this aloneness, in the midst of this desperation. Even when he feels like God has abandoned him, he refuses to abandon God. I'll read Psalm 22, where Jesus is quoting from. My God, why have you abandoned me? Why are you so far away when I groan for help? Every day I call to you, my God, but you do not answer. Every night I lift my voice, but I find no relief. Yet you are holy, enthroned on the praises of Israel. Our ancestors trusted in you and you rescued them. They cried out to you and were saved. They trusted in you and were never disgraced. But I am a worm and not a man. I am scorned and despised by all. Everyone who sees me mocks me. They sneer and shake their heads, saying, "Is this the one who relies on the Lord? Then let the Lord save him. If the Lord loves him so much, let the Lord rescue him." Yet you brought me safely from my mother's womb and led me to trust you at my mother's breast. I was thrust into your arms at my birth. You have been my God from the moment I was born. Do not stay so far from me, for trouble is near and no one else can help me. My enemies surround me like a herd of bulls. Fierce bulls of Bashan have hemmed me in. Like lions, they open their jaws against me, roaring and tearing into their prey. My life is poured out like water, and my bones are out of joint. My heart melts like wax within me. My strength is dried up like sunbaked clay. My tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You have laid me in the dust and left me for dead. My enemies surround me like a pack of dogs. An evil gang closes in on me. They have pierced my hands and feet. I can count all my bones. My enemies stare at me and gloat. They divide my garments among themselves and throw dice for my clothing. O Lord, do not stay far away. You are my strength. Come quickly to my aid. Save me from the sword. Spare my precious life from those dogs. Snatch me from the lion's jaws and from the horns of these wild oxen. It's not where it ends. We've all been there. We felt that discouragement. But David kept going. I will proclaim your name to my brothers and sisters. I will praise you among your assembled people. Praise the Lord, all you who fear him. Honor him, all you descendants of Jacob. Show him reverence, all you descendants of Israel. For he is not ignored or belittled. For he has not ignored or belittled the suffering of the needy. He has not turned his back on them, but has listened to their cries for help. I will praise you in the great assembly. I will fulfill my vows in the presence of those who worship you. The poor will eat and be satisfied. All who seek the Lord will praise him. Their hearts will rejoice with everlasting joy. The whole earth will acknowledge the Lord and return to him. All the families of the nations will bow down before him. For royal power belongs to the Lord. He rules the nations. Let the rich of the earth feast and worship. Bow down before him all who are mortal, all whose lives will end as dust. our children will also serve him. Future generations will hear about the wonders of the Lord. His righteous acts will be told to those not yet born. They will hear about everything he has done. One of my favorite things Jesus said in everything recorded in any of the Gospels is in Matthew chapter 10, verse 29, where Jesus says, he's talking about death and loss and suffering. And he says, "Are not two sparrows sold for a few pennies? And yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father." Some versions smooth this out to read "apart from the will of your Father." But I think it is much better as it was written. Two sparrows, something worth less than a penny. These tiny little lives that don't seem to matter much at all. Every day they are born, every day they die. And Jesus says not even one of these littlest parts of creation fall to the ground apart from your Father. Sparrows do fall to the ground. Sparrows do die. So do we. But Jesus insists that not even one of the least of these creatures dies separate from God, apart from God. That in the suffering, in the death, in the tragedy, God is present just as much as anywhere else. Tragedy happens. Loss happens. Uncertainty and lack of control are a very real part of our lives. Can't deny that right now. But none of these things mean that we are abandoned. Even when we feel like it, even when we are going through the valley of the shadow of death, even when we may feel like Jesus, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus himself insists that even at those places, God is not separate from us. God is not apart from anything that is happening to any of us at any time. Emmanuel, God with us, means God is with us everywhere, at all times, in all things. God present in our suffering is precisely what we see on the cross, that the God who created everything is not separate from our suffering, from the darkness we go through. This form of prayer, of lament, is such a rich part of Christian tradition, of being willing to sit there in the suffering, recognizing that God is present in this too. I think the incredible transformative power of this is it stops us from frantically needing to get out of our suffering. We can suffer. Maybe we can even suffer gladly, knowing that it is not something destroying us. Like Jesus, we can turn our hearts and our minds to God, even in the midst of our suffering, even when we feel like God isn't doing what we wish God was, that God isn't saving us the way we wish we were being saved, that God is nonetheless present, that whatever God is doing and giving to us is probably better than that which we had in mind in the first place, that God might be taking away our hope to give us a better hope, that our hearts might be breaking, but a better love is coming. I want to end today. It's hard. I was looking through the hymnal. There's not very many songs that just sit and stay present with this loss, with this sense of sadness and lament. We love the happy, triumphant songs. We can't wait for Easter next week and the promise of resurrection and rebirth and all things made new. But there are times, and I think it's important to honor those and respect them, like this week, when we can just stop and be present with how difficult and hard and discouraging sometimes life is. These experiences cannot be separated from the rest of life. They are part of it. And I want my prayer to be Jesus's, my God, to turn my attention to him. And I want to end today with O Come, Emmanuel, which is traditionally an Advent hymn. But it is a hymn in a minor key that is sad and meant to be sung in the darkness, praying for light. And I think that is where we are today. That is where our world is. That is where Jesus is on the cross, is in the dark, but still praying for light, still wanting presence, and still remaining present with God. So on this today with O Come, O Come, Emmanuel, you can join me in singing if you want, or just listen. And let this be our prayer as we go through the midst of this. O come, O come, Emmanuel, and ransom captive Israel that mourns in lonely exile here, until the Son of God appear. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O O come, thou day spring, come and cheer our spirits by thine advent here. Disperse the gloomy clouds of night and death's dark shadows put to rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel. O come, thou wisdom from on high, and order all things far. The path of knowledge show, and cause in us her ways to go. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel. All right, everyone. Love you. Be safe. Hang in there. We'll see you next Sunday.